Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
It's a Friday edition here on Zero Block 30, and I gotta be honest, my Wellbutrin is working. I'm feeling good. I'm out of, like, my depression cycle, which is awesome. I actually feel like waking up in the morning. That's dope. So we're gonna have a good edition here of Zero Block 30. Today, we have... How many? Six rounds of the magazine. Round number one, we're going to act like we're skinny dipping illegally in Panama City beachfront motel pool with this round. But a fella in Russia was killed. And the story is, can I say it? Kate, don't be mad. It's honestly kind of hilarious how he was killed.
Round number two,
step aside, Moses. There's a new locust in town, and these little hornnut bugs aren't destroying the crops of the Egyptians. They're finding bombs. For real. Round number three, there's a new Call of Duty coming out, and I'm fucking furious about that. Round number four, damn, Ma. A CIA operative is charged with being a double agent for China. Round number five, Khan sat down with Daniel Rodriguez, who survived the Battle of Camdish, walked on the Clemson football team, wrote a book, brought it full cycle playing himself in the movie The Outpost. And Khan didn't mention this when he wrote that little round. He's also a musician. Have you seen him on Twitter and stuff like that?
He's a Nashville, beats.
His living room is unbelievably cool. Mm-hmm. He has, like, all this DJ shit, all this music stuff, and then he has, like, Rogue Fitness in there, too. So I guess this guy just goes from, like, ripping kettlebells to ripping the guitar. What a life Daniel Rodriguez is living. The full life. He's like a Forrest Gump kind of guy.
Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, you're absolutely right.
But he has a better intellect than Forrest.
Yes.
Round number six, it's not just the Marines banning walking and talking on a cell phone. Now a town in Japan is following suit for civilians. Are umbrellas next? I certainly hope so. Mm-hmm. And all of that today is going to be brought to you by our good friends at Rocky Boots. If you're going around town and you're headed out into Japan and you're not wearing your, you're not walking and talking, you might be walking in your... What am I saying?
What Rocky are you boots. Doing here? Yeah. Rocky
I
boots.
Tried to tie it together. It just wouldn't work. It. Honest to God, I lost the ad read. So I'm going to put myself on fire watch because I'm looking for it now. I knew I have it. I had it pulled up. What is going on? I can't find it anywhere. I'm still going to go. Let's find it. Nope, that's the wrong email account. My God.
Oh, my God.
All right, you guys talk amongst yourselves.
Okay, we're talking amongst ourselves. You know
what? While we're waiting for that, I'm going to get something off my chest right now, and I'm going to talk about one of the reasons I hate Kate.
Okay.
Kate is blessed, and she doesn't realize it, but Kate is blessed. She eats like a trash compactor. The pizza, the mac and cheese, all the good stuff that isn't good for you. But she's still just a little skinny mini. If I ate the way Kate ate, I would look disgusting. I'd be sweating all the time. My skin would look horrible.
You'd look like that infamous picture of me.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know what it is.
Like a greasy fuck.
But so I had that thought this week, Kate, that I actually hate you.
I'm awake about 22 hours a day.
So you're always burning.
So I'm always burning energy. And also, I'm always strapping on my Rocky boots and going for big, long hikes and strolls. And they are the best boots for men and women that serve and protect our country. They're designed and built in the United States of America for each individual branch of the university. God, chaps, take it from here. Military,
Even the USMC, you can wear them now. We used to have the strictest rules about the boots, but these bad boys are berry compliant,
love
which
them.
Means that they fit. What's the Marine Corps order on dress, Kate?
32.7B.
No. Kyle, you want to give it a try?
Up a 1020.34 hotel now.
Oh, there we go. Yeah.
And
so a couple
in the army. In the army, 670-1.
Yeah, no one cares. That's the problem. I mean, it really is unfair to the rest of the listeners that are in like the Navy and the Air Force that the Marines have three voices on this show and the Army has one, and the one Army voice is the officer. So that doesn't even really count.
I might as well not be here with the three.
So if you want to wear some Vibrant Cup outsoles, make sure that you go with Rocky Boots because they are unbelievably comfortable. I've been wearing them doing DIY projects around my house. They even keep my little bitch ass ankles straight and help me not roll them over and over and over again. Even the shirts. Now, this is a boot ad, and you can get 25% off your next pair of boots. They sent me a shirt.
I love that shirt.
That might be the most comfortable shirt of all time. Yep. It's like woven with angel hair. I don't know how they made a shirt this soft, but it's incredibly soft. So not only go to rockyboots.com and get your pair of boots for 25% off with the promo code ZBT, but also throw you in a comfortable little shirt because it's the choir, damn it. You deserve to be comfortable.
I gotta tell you, I hike in and I have actually taken both pairs now. I had a non-military pair that they sent, but the USMC Tropic boot they also sent me. And I've taken that pair out for a hike now, too, with the Rocky shirt tied. Ladies, ooh, tied in a little knot. I felt like a hot patoot out on the trail. Patoot, I got to tell you. So a comfy hot patoot. So.
Kate, can you do me a favor?
Sure.
Can you turn into just do one weekend and be ultra boot? And get a big backpack, get your put your Rocky boots on, find your McMap belt, the tan one. Don't like if you went up, I don't know how high you went in McMap, but wear like your tan belt and get a, you have to have a camelback and then a cowboy hat.
You know what? You know the show Undercover Boss?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I should go to the different bases and write in the towns right outside on the weekends and do Undercover Boot. And bring a little camera and see how all the boots are living and what they're doing and if I can blend in and fit in.
Do any of you remember the name of the little fella who chimed us on Twitter about us calling him out for being 5'7 and wearing a cowboy hat and being super skinny?
Oh, he was a delight.
Yeah.
Shout out to that guy. You wear it. You're from Louisiana. You could do it, my friend. We're calling Baton Rouge like Garth Brooks. Let's get started.
Well, wait, goddammit. Did you say 25% off if you use promo code ZBT? Okay, rockyboots.com. We really...
I appreciate you keeping me accountable today because I really fucked up by not having that. I don't know what's going on. My brain is feeling good, but it is still all over the place because I am still me. Let's get started with the show. Here's a little music. I'd love to go through second puberty. I think that should be a thing. You get like 40, 42, your body adjusts again. You know what? It should happen. So whenever you want to have kids or whatever, it should almost be like you're married and Amish whenever you have to start growing a beard. Once you get a vasectomy... and you say, I'm done, all that hair that comes after puberty should go away. I would love to be like sheer like a baby again.
Sure, why not?
Yeah.
And as Kate pointed out this morning, I wouldn't mind doing that too because I got some hairy ass arms.
Yeah, I was thinking like butt cheeks. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. My wrist looks like a butt, apparently.
His wrist, he's got, Cons has, when babies look like they've got rubber bands on their wrists. That's what Cons looks like.
That's mean. So we have a couple things that are happening right now. One, Kate texted us this morning asking us what the Labor Day schedule is. And this, it got me thinking, this is the first year I don't think holidays exist.
Yeah.
2020 has zero holidays. Yeah. You won't remember a single birthday. You won't remember Easter. You don't remember what happened on 4th of July because you most likely didn't do shit. And now we have Labor Day coming up. And Kate texted that, are we going to have radio? We are going to have radio on Friday, but not on Monday. And she said, she told me that she might be going on a little road trip to New Hampshire, right, Kate?
Yes, taking my Rocky boots. It's one of my favorite hiking spots, the White Mountains up there. One of my favorite hiking spots on the planet. Just really beautiful.
Where I've always thought that New Hampshire sounds like the fanciest place in the country. I mean, I don't know if it is. I've heard that Vermont used to be really, like, sounding fancy to me. But I've heard that Vermont is basically just New England, Alabama.
Well, New Hampshire is like live free or die. It's a very like no rules here. It's like a very
libertarian.
I don't even think there's speed limit signs or something. It's like you just do you. It's like a very chill, like find your little enclaves and hang out. Like, I don't know. I really like it up there.
Have any of you ever been to Portsmouth, New Hampshire?
No,
I don't think I've ever been to New Hampshire.
So it's a buddy of mine used to be the offensive coordinator at UNH. And so I used to go up for a game every year. And Portsmouth was always a very nice town.
I don't think I've been north in America above Rhode Island. I think that's the furthest I've gone north.
You're missing out. Well, I'm going to disappear in the boonies up there.
As soon as Kate said she was going to New Hampshire, I said, I have a mission for you, and I hope that you can accomplish this mission, Kate. I would love it if you could go and find the Bartlett brandy from West Wing.
Wow.
President Bartlett has a brandy that he makes or that they make and put his name on it. I need to have a bottle of Bartlett brandy.
That's
on my
a real
shelf.
Thing.
Yes, it's a real thing.
All right. I didn't know that.
Yeah, no free ads, but it's a thing and it looks delicious. And I believe it has President Bartlett's bust on it, just like in the like normal George Washington would be. I think it's black and white, and it's a nice little color. I would love to have that on my shelf. So if you go to New Hampshire, you got to find that.
Okay, I'm going to go looking. I'm going to give it a whirl.
I think they actually sell it in a lot of places up there, just not down here. So I think you could find it pretty easily.
My guess is you could probably get it on the old World Wide Web, too, if you wanted.
Yeah,
but it's hard. Dude, people always say that Texas is this really free state. With booze, it is not, man. There are so many rules. For instance, you cannot buy beer at a gas station or grocery store. Liquor stores are flat out closed on Sundays. Mm-hmm. But you can't buy beer until noon. So noon kickoff, like if you don't get your beer on Saturday, you miss noon kickoff on Sunday.
Yeah.
That's bullshit.
That stinks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can't. They don't even sell like the Kirkland brand, the Costco brand liquor. Not allowed to sell it here in Texas. Insane. Insane. All right, let's get started with the actual show. Nobody wants to hear about that. Today, we have a lot of things going on around the world. But the first one that we're going to talk about today is what happened in Russia. I felt a little bit bad about laughing at it. And I think it really bubbled over because of that fake North Korea Twitter account. Kate hasn't read it yet. She's just reading it now. And she's going to be mad about this round. I just know it. So I want to explain what's going on. We don't condone murder or assassination of political rivals. That's obvious. But it is not in true military fashion if you can't laugh at some of this stuff. The fact that this thing still goes on, this legitimately is like 1700s type of shit to me, where people are getting poisoned in Russia. They're poisoning people. They're pushing folks out the window that are talking about coronavirus. Russia is still in the dark ages, essentially. Do you guys agree with that?
In a lot of ways, you're 100% correct, and this is no different than that.
Yeah.
And this story is terrible because this guy is one of the main folks, or was one of the main folks, that was going up against Putin and Putin's terrible regime, where he is obviously a brutal dictator and keeps things under wraps. No one in the world believes that Putin wins elections by 90%. He just flat out doesn't. It's fixed. Now he's in power until, I believe, like 2036 or something like that. It's crazy what's happening in Russia, but the main opposition figure was in a coma on Thursday after drinking a cup of tea that his spokeswoman suspected was deliberately laced with poison, a method used before in plots linked to Russian agents by the Western intelligence and others. The guy said that Navalny, I think that's how you'll say his name, started to feel ill during a flight to Moscow from the Serbian city of Tomsk. Did I nail that? I think I nailed that.
I think that. So. Yeah, Tomsk? I think you did.
Mm-hmm. He is leading the pilot to make an emergency landing in Omsk. So from Tomsk to Omsk, and where he was taken to the hospital and was put on a ventilator. The possible poisoning is the latest in a series of fates suffered by high-profile Kremlin critics, stroking speculations that the regime's involvement. This guy also asserted on Twitter that it was Putin. Like, he just flat out said it, which is dangerous, man. Like, these people speaking up against Putin in Russia, we saw
really
what happened
brave
to the Pussycat Dolls, our girls. Not dolls. What is it? No,
Pussy Riot. Pussy Riot, right. The Pussycat Dolls are okay. they're okay.
What? I would love the Pussycat Girls just to go become big-time lobbyists in what's going on in Russia. That's their jam. They're big-time involved in that. So Pussy Riot did that.
They'd be the Dixie Chicks of 2020.
Mm-hmm. And then they are... Pussy Riot was put in prison because they would go to these concerts and they would talk about politically charged things, and they were put in Russian jails. And now this guy is speaking out against the regime that Putin has, and he ends up taking tea that is poison. And I believe he's dead now. But the Kremlin is saying that if this is actually what happened, they're going to investigate. Do you believe that is true?
Not for a second. Not even a little bit. Not a morsel of that.
Alexei Navalny is his name, and he is still in a coma. So he's alive for now, but who knows? But this is a common thing. There's that Netflix show right now with like the top, it's like 10 episodes, and it's the top most wanted criminals in the world. And another one that this story brings up, we all remember Alexander Litvinenko, That story from 2006 when he was a former spy and dissident against the Russia's government, and he was in England, in London, and Putin basically responsible for putting polonium in his tea, and he died a very slow, horrible, horrible death that the whole world watched over the course of a month while he pretty much just shriveled up into nothing and died. And his daughter, Yulia, was also poisoned in, Sergei Skripal, a former double agent, and his daughter, Yulia, were also poisoned with a deadly Soviet nerve agent in 2018. So this is, normally these kind of poisoning deaths are like slow and awful, and it kind of sends a message like, this is exactly what could happen to you. And blah,
seriously.
Blah, blah.
And Kyle, fact check me on this one, as our ZBT historian, but I think the last time that there have been some serious attempts at poisoning were both Fidel Castro, we tried to poison his cigars, and also we also tried killing Hitler with poison, I think. Ooh. I don't know, maybe I'm just kind of talking out of my butt.
No, I like it, let's go with it.
What's unreal to me with these people who are speaking up, yes, it is actually very brave to speak up and against Putin, but talk about the all-time looking over your shoulder when you speak up, because he's got no remorse at taking people out, and it's very clear that he has no remorse about this. So unless you have a way out of Russia, you got to just keep your head down and keep it moving, because otherwise you could just essentially count down your days, because that your life is numbered.
But I think
like that in North Korea, it's not even that you have a way out, because your family is still there.
Right.
And they'll come get your family. They don't care. Somebody connected to you is going to feel that pain. It's unbelievable, man. Like, next on Tuesday's episode, I interviewed a CIA agent who did 25 years, some of which was in China. And then there's a businessman that is going to join him on Tuesday's episode. And his company designed these diamond plated cell phone cases, and they do all kinds of defense contracts too. And he actually was approached by a Chinese spy, and they stole a lot of the information. This guy that came on our podcast legitimately is brave. He's not a member of the CIA or the FBI or a protected government agent or anything like that. He's a legit businessman who's coming on and really putting himself out there, be like, this is what they're doing, and this is why it's fucked up.
Yeah, and I think, too, a lot of them accept that. Like, that's just how brave they are, that they know things, that they're so desperate for the movement to move forward and things to change that it's, you know what? I have seen very clearly from past examples what my fate will probably be, and zero fucks given anymore. You just have to keep pushing forward and trying. Because even then, they interviewed the hospital where this man is, where he is right now, and says there's no certainty that the cause of his condition is poisoning. Even the hospital is afraid to
say, it.
What it is. And I guess, is that the part that you're saying is funny, is that we all know?
No. The only part that I'm saying, I don't think any of the poisoning stuff is funny. The only reason why I laughed at it is because there's this Twitter account that's kind of like the Onion for North Korean news, and they put out their headline for it: another high-profile Russian politician suffers from tea allergy. That's how they phrased it.
That's what I'm getting at, Chaps. That's what I'm saying. The funny thing to everybody, and I know funny maybe isn't the right word for it, but like, we all know the Russian government comes out with these things saying, and I think at this point we all roll our eyes. We all know it's fake. They know we know it's fake, but it's just this thing that they play. It's just this dumb game.
We talked about the same issue whenever there was like four people that fell out the same window
in
Russia because they were talking about coronavirus and how it was affecting people there.
Right. It's so much, and it comes to mind that when you say the Dark Ages, I feel like the whole idea of if you do something wrong, your whole family gets killed is something from the Dark Ages. We as a civilization across the world.
Off the top of your head, when did the Dark Ages start?
Goodness gracious, bro. I don't know. 1200, 1250?
I have no idea.
I have no idea.
Kyle, do you know?
So you're really not supposed to say Dark Ages because a lot of progress happened during it. But it's usually like, I don't know, like 1200 to... until the Age of Enlightenment or whatever.
Boom, what's up?
I don't fucking know. Everyone's dead then, so it's not that important.
Nailed it.
Good job, everybody. Well done.
As a human race, we've progressed most part in most countries where if you do something wrong, you need to fear for something to happen to your family, except in certain situations like here in Russia. So that's why it's very much that they are stuck in the Dark Ages.
And I just want to say, too, this Navalny, the man who has been poisoned, he was the running as the opposition party. He has been fighting for so long. He started out actually as a popular blogger, YouTube, Twitter channels, all the way back. Like, he has almost 4 million followers now, but he came to prominence through a blog in the early 2010s and really started picking up as a voice of the opposition. So he's been imprisoned in 2013 and 2014. They said, oh, you're an embezzler, you're this, you're that. They're coming up with all these fake charges against him. According to the European Court of Human Rights, he was never given fair trials. He has been put in jail and on house arrest and restricted from communicating with anyone but his family. He created an anti-corruption foundation in 2017, accusing all the others of corrupt. So, like, even after they imprison him, he's still fighting back. And so now this is what has happened to him. So this is somebody who for like over a decade now has been
super brave guy. Yeah, that's going out there and doing all kinds of stuff.
44 years old. That's it.
And one of my favorite things that he did, I don't know if you guys saw it, but he had this YouTube series that he would do on YouTube, and where he started in Moscow, and he said that he was going to taste every single baklava in Moscow and he was going to rate it, and he did it on a scale of 1 to 10, and celebrities and things like that would join him. It was
very cool.
Yeah, so that's what was going on in there. Kate, we did pretty, you want to rate that round of how we handled ourselves? Because I did call it funny, but I think that we handled ourselves pretty well.
Yes, I think in the beginning it was a little misleading, but what you found funny, but we came to a common understanding there. Yes.
Yeah, we don't want to be huge pieces of shit. This dude should not have been poisoned. Yeah. And I'll go ahead and say it. Putin should be. There we go.
Yeah, there you go.
So we'll flip the script a little bit there. Let's move on to round number two, which is going to be brought to you by our good friends at Daddy. Now, I don't know if you guys are familiar with this company or not, like the listener. I know Cons and Kate and Kyle are, but there's this company called Daddy, and it is a very difficult thing. Like, there's so many people in the military that are trying to have kids, and sometimes you have a really short window. I mean, I've read stories now where people have been deployed 8, 9 times, 10 times or whatever, and the time that you're home is very small. So if you want to make sure that you can, I guess, procreate and do whatever you need to do there, this is a good way to test to see if you're going to be able to, or if you need to have fertility treatments and things like that. And it's great. And you could do it in the privacy of your own home. As somebody who's had a vasectomy and has had to drop off a, quote, specimen, that shit is legitimately humiliating. It is, you just feel like an animal. Like, you go in there and you have this little cup, and I went on base. They're not giving you any materials to look at, and your cell phone doesn't work on Lackland. And they're like, produce a specimen. And you're like, all right, I gotta go far
come
back
on
to the
imagination.
Reaches of the old,
yeah,
the old imagination, the old spank bank. Mm-hmm. So you pull this out. Daddy's product is completely different in that regard, where you could do it in the privacy of your own home, put it in a box that's discreet, and mail it off, which is incredible. Like, it really is going to help people save a lot of embarrassment, because we talk about sex stuff very openly on this show, but a lot of people aren't the way that we are. They're a lot more private with that thing, and they don't want somebody looking them in the eye right before they jerk off, which is normal. So if you don't want to do that, go to Daddy Kit, DaddyKit.com, and enter your kit and enter the promo code ZBT50. You're going to get 50% off your first, or $50 off your first purchase. Unbelievable. They'll freeze your sperm if you're worried about having kids and you think that something might happen. We've seen stories about that on deployments where people are injured, and they are injured in their groin and they can't have kids, and that shit is heartbreaking. So it'd be smart for you, if you were going to go on a deployment to a place that is commonly known for IEDs, to get your sperm frozen, because I think if you come back and you have that peace of mind, it is something that you can keep in the back of your mind, that you're like, okay, at least that's good. So go to daddykit.com, enter the promo code ZBT50. You're going to get $50 off the $199, and they're going to keep your sperm for a year, and that's all it's going to cost. It's a pretty incredible deal. Make sure you do that. Let's move on to round number two. Kate, what do we have for round two?
For round number two, we have Navy-funded researchers discovering locusts have sensitive horns that can distinguish between the scents of TNT and other explosives. So we got bomb-sniffing locusts, my friends. Mm-hmm. It's a development that could one day herald the deployment of bomb-sniffing electronically augmented bug swarms. The research aims to tap into the antenna and brain power of garden-variety bugs to create an advanced bomb detection sensor.
Now, can I stop you there before you continue?
Yeah.
When I was reading this article, this is the most intrigued military news that I have read in a long time. Think about those three paragraphs that you just read. That one day we could have the ability to control robotically controlled bugs in a combat zone. Like sending if you send a locust swarm at me as a dog handler and I'm walking down the street and you're just like, get them to a swarm of locusts, I'm surrendering. I'm not going. No matter what, I would be a conscientious objector.
There you go. Yeah, people don't love the bugs. They call them biorobotics, mixing technology and bugs pretty much and like nature to do this kind of stuff. And locusts, which differ from ordinary grasshoppers in their tendency to swarm, sometimes in biblical proportions, have had about 250 million years to refine their little sniffers. A single antenna or horn has 50,000 neurons and some 50 different types. So that's like our taste buds on steroids, pretty much. This makes for far more perfected and complex sensing organs and systems developed by engineers whose doctoral research focused on electronic noses. For the past 4 years, labs have studied how those advanced biological sensors could be hijacked and coupled with modern computing power. What we did not know was something like a TNT or DNT, which has no meaning to the insects, you would not expect them to have sensors for that. But it turns out the insects do have sensors for them, and very exquisite ones, because they can pick up some of these odors at extremely low concentrations. We're talking like parts per billion and below. The new peer-reviewed study found that the tiny herbivores can distinguish not only between the vapors from explosive chemicals and ammonium nitrate, they can do so within a fraction of a second and can sense where the scent is coming from. The American locusts used in the study appear to work better as bomb sniffers when in a swarm. Data from a group of 7 bugs gave accurate results about 80% of the time, compared with about 60% on average for lone bugs. So another thing that I imagined right away was countries like Cambodia and Afghanistan, where there's unexploded ordnances killing children, innocent children, and communities. And if you could send these swarms in to find them all, that would be awesome.
Yeah, because like people don't have the stomach to do it to dogs. Like they, like what you were saying there, whenever there was minefields in Cambodia and they trained rats to do it because rats have the same type of smelling that dogs do. So they could do it. So they trained these rats and they would send them out. And they, how they did the training was they would put like cheese or meat on top of an old mine. And so the rats in training would go, they would smell that out and then they would be able to go eat that. So the rats did this in Cambodia or in Afghanistan, somewhere like that, and they would go across the fields, and then they would blow the fuck up. Like, they are essentially sending these animals out to die. And we used to have it because I was at Quantico, and we actually did this training day where the TSA and some other organizations were trying to come up with an electronic nose, is what they were calling it, to see if it could pick up. Because really, the process of training dogs is very, very expensive. And I find the information at the bottom of this article very interesting, that they say 80%. Bomb dogs in the DOD don't get certified unless they're at 95. They have to maintain a 95% standard. So dogs are still much, much better than these locusts. But they also are at the very initial stages of this peer-reviewed study, too. Right. But the robots that they would create, you would have MIT scientists and engineers and the smartest people in the world trying to do this, and a dog would come in and blow these things out of the water. Like, how nature and evolution works is incredible.
Yeah. No, the fact that my first question, I read this, and my first thought is, how? How are you going to tell me you know that these locusts know what they're looking for? Or you know that they're looking for exactly – I get that you can train them to an extent. Or, you know, you're talking about these rats. I don't know how you do that with locusts. I guess these scientists are obviously –
it's a lot of experimenting.
Yeah, a lot smarter than me, and you're right because with a dog, you'd be very sad to see a dog get blown up in a minefield. A rat – yeah, not as bad. Locusts, that's just as how often care. You walk down
they're
the street.
Really blowing up or anything. They're just finding it. You know, they're just swarming on whatever.
And that's part of it. They wouldn't even have to blow up.
True, they wouldn't even have to die. They wouldn't even have to make
that
sacrifice
for us. So
for all
the locust groups out there ready to come at us, we don't want to be locusts.
We don't want big locusts.
But imagine walking down the street, Kate, in your neighborhood of Queens and being like, you know what? I just saw this locust swarm. I bet those motherfuckers can find bombs. Like, how does that even go into your brain? Like, that's a thing.
Well, I guess, you know, as a scientist thinking, well, how do they know exactly where to swarm? Oh, they have these, like, deep innate sensors. I wonder if it works on other stuff. Like, I wonder if that's the thought process there, but it's really, really cool. I mean, they're talking about putting little cameras on bees to, like, go into places. Like, there's all sorts of cool shit that bugs are getting used for.
Listen, I don't know how they're doing it, but I'm happy that they are doing it.
The only problem.
Well, I want to get this fella on the podcast, the guy who did it, the main scientist. I want to get him, pick his brain. And I think a lot of it, just because I'm a dog handler, I'm really interested of how they do that, because those five explosives that they listed there, that's five of the nine that we train our dogs on. So they're getting pretty far down the road of how they could do this. And if they raise that 80% to 85%, I mean, it can't be that much to breed locusts. I mean, if you're doing that.
Now, picture putting a saddle on a dog and having a bunch of locusts riding the dog. And then they can lift him up. They're on strings.
No. It's almost like that song from elementary school. There's a hole in the bottom of the sea, and then it ends. There's a flea on the hair, on the floor, on the flog, on the nog, on the
Oh, yeah, it's like the Ratlin bug.
You should have a dog with a rat on its back, and the rat controls the locust.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you got to get him on the show. We have some ideas.
We're getting weirder and weirder here, but I'm here for this. But my only other thing is, you must have to train or reproduce a ton of locusts, because a dog, it goes and works for you. It knows to come back because it wants to get fed. Rats, locusts.
Except for that one time in Fallujah. Mm. Yeah. Shout out Robinson, lost his damn dog.
Yeah, sorry. But right, like, I would think locusts, they go, they do their job, and then they probably just fly off. I don't know. I don't know how you control locusts.
Yeah. And what if you're sitting around and somebody, like, you're the fucking locust handler, and you got all your locusts, and somebody sees it, and you're not paying attention, you're getting yourself another Starbucks, and you're sitting there at the airport just waiting to go back to Japan. Next thing you know, some dickhead janitor comes out with Raid and starts killing all your working locusts.
Very true.
Explain that to your staff and CO.
I'm sorry, real quickly. Do you think they name the locusts?
Oh, yeah. Well, not name. If they're going to be military, they're definitely going to have a serial number.
Yeah. Yeah. They'll have a barcode on them or something. I just had a daydream where I have an ex that I'd like to torment. If I was a scientist with free time, imagine your ex walking down the street and all of a sudden just a swarm of locusts. You wait till they're on a date? Come on.
Do you think that would be worse? Or if you train the locusts or whatever, a flying insect that makes all kinds of noise, and every night you have one that goes into their bedroom and is just like buzzing around their head right when they're trying to sleep and drive them insane.
Well, one time in college, we went to the pet store and we bought a ton of crickets and we released them in the men's rugby house.
That's fucked up.
Very loud.
So I think this is also an intimidation factor if we start utilizing locusts too, because I think there are some cultures will just think it's the plague coming back for them again.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, there is, and that is back. I mean, the plague's back big time.
Yeah.
I mean, the locust plagues are destroying certain countries in Africa where they have millions and millions that are swarming and eating all the crops there. It's terrible. It's causing a famine in a lot of parts of the world. Let's move on to round number three. That was a really callous move on. Like, mention.
That was a heavy.
That was very callous on my behalf. Sorry about that. Next up, we have a story from round number three, from Task and Purpose, from James Clark. I've recently started trying to play Call of Duty with my older kid, Kelsey. I have the big screen in the back. I have the projector, and we play in here, usually Sunday afternoon. I have like a gym floor on my floor now where it's pretty soft, and we have these big bread pillows that we lay on, and she and I will play. I turn on Call of Duty every time there's like a 2-hour update that needs to go. And I'm finally getting to the point where I don't die over and over and over again in Call of Duty. And then I scroll on Twitter and I see this article that a new one's coming out. They gotta fucking stop it, man. Just stop releasing new stuff and stop having updates in video games. That's really all I want to say about round three.
Okay.
Let's move on to round number four.
Oh, really? Really quickly, I'll just allow me to piggyback there, Staff Sergeant.
Right. Okay.
I just found last night there is a documentary series on Netflix called Game Over, and it's about video games and how they came up through the 80s and 90s, and I think if there's anybody in and around our age, they would find it very interesting. I watched 1.5 episodes so far last night about Nintendo and then Sega Genesis. Mm-hmm. Pretty fascinating stuff that I didn't know a lot about before. So if you're looking for something to watch, there you go.
Okay. Round number 4, we're going to get into it. And this one comes to us from Task and Purpose again. No, actually, it comes Reuters. That's right. We got roasted one time for saying Reuters wrong. It's Reuters, right?
I don't know.
Reuters? Yeah, it is Reuters.
Kyle?
Yeah.
Reuters?
I think it's Reuters.
It's Reuters.
Okay, Reuters. We got Reuters. That's where it came from. This story, more China talk, folks. A former CIA agency officer. Nope, just... Oh. A former CIA officer was arrested and charged with spying for China in a scheme that involved a relative who had also worked for the CIA, the U.S. Justice Department said on Monday. It said in a statement that Alexander Yuk-Ching Ma, who's 67, was arrested on Friday on a charge that he conspired with a relative, also a former CIA officer, to communicate classified information to Chinese intelligence officials. The criminal complaint was unsealed on Monday. A naturalized American, Ma started to work for the CIA in 1982 with top secret security clearance. Prosecutors said that Ma left the CIA in 1989 and lived and worked in Shanghai, China before arriving in Hawaii in 2001. Prosecutors said the unnamed relative with whom Ma conspired also worked for the CIA, but resigned from the agency in 1983 following allegations that they used their official position to help Chinese citizens enter the United States. Prosecutors said that around 1998, Ma's relative was convicted of making false statements leading to a leading lending institution, and said that the relative, who's now 85, isn't charged because he's about to fucking die anyways. Prosecutors said that Ma was spying in March of 2001, during which the two former CIA provided information to China. Imagine the stones to be a current fucking double agent. Like, to do that, to be in America, work for the CIA, have a top secret security clearance, and then purport all of that information back to China. What are you thinking, Ma?
Yeah, either, I mean, of all the countries, China's a hell of a pick.
Go ahead. It's really difficult and stressful to do, or it's, like, actually pretty easy. Nobody's really tracking what I'm up to, so I don't know. Again, yeah, just send me some letters.
Cash rules everything, right? Like, the prosecutor said that one meeting was recorded on videotape in which Ma could be seen counting $50,000 in cash he received for secrets. The court document said that Ma moved to Hawaii. He sought employment with the FBI to regain access to the U.S. government. The Honolulu office of the FBI hired Ma as a contract linguist in 2004, and the CIA and the FBI declined to comment why it took so long to arrest him. Probably because they're watching everything else that he's doing. Like, if you know someone's doing that and the information that they're leaking, which you can control what they can see after you already know, it, like, unleashes all these different tentacles.
Maybe it's misinformation that they're giving them then to pass that, on.
That's, I think, where you start to get confused. Real quickly, cash rules everything around me. Shout to Wu-Tang. But where you just keep going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, you kind of forget, who am I even working for anymore? Which lie am I telling today? Okay, I'm sorry, it's Thursday.
Who does number two Ma work for?
Yes.
That's got to be one of the hardest challenges, is remembering, all right, who am I working for this week? What am I trying to accomplish?
I just hope it's misinformation and China thinks we're working on bomb-sniffing worms.
Yeah, bunch of idiots.
God is ass.
But doing that for, and I don't mean to shake my head at 50 grand, 50 grand is not enough for me to be a double agent.
No, not even close.
China, if you're listening, Russia, if you're listening, to quote the president, let me know if you want me to be a double agent. $1 million. $1 million and I'd think about it.
I'm going at least 20.
I need,
because here's what I need. Because as a double agent, what are you doing? You're putting your life on the line. So I need an amount of money that I can survive on for the rest of my life.
That's not true. You did it for $56,000 a year before.
Oh, that's a good point. That's a very good point.
That's true. I would say if I was 7 pina coladas deep or 5 margaritas deep and I'm on a dock, on a beautiful dock, and I'm feeling good, and this dream pontoon boat rolls up, it's got a sliding board, a grill, a double deck, it's large Marge the Party Barge, I got a diving board, all the accoutrements are on it, and a man from China steps off and says, hey, The keys are right there. All you got to do, information. I don't have a tough time.
Especially if they're really handsome.
If you're a recruiter for
the CIA or whoever from whatever country, right, and you're a very attractive lady or gentleman, that's going to put asses in the seats. People are going to listen.
Say, for instance, Kate,
just for you, like say you're a student at the University of Virginia and the year is 1983. You're at the University of Virginia. Some lad comes up to you, tall, handsome, blonde hair, blue eyes, 6'4", unbelievable shoulders and traps. He has a little bit of a Swedish accent, and he starts talking to you. This guy,
Gertie Gertie,
sounds like the chef from Muppets. Right.
This guy is an 11 on the scale of 10. You're sitting there. No disrespect to you, but you're a UVA 6.8, and he wants to take you out to dinner, and he is relentless. You're listening. You just are.
Chaps, that was mean.
That was hurtful, but also, yes, I would be interested.
Well, I went up. Yesterday on radio, you said you were a 6'7". I brought you up a tenth of a point.
Thank you.
Which was kind of nice. And UVA has lots of attractive people. So
that's
being a
6.8
there, nothing to shake a stick at.
Yes, absolutely. But I would see through it right away. Sorry. I wouldn't fall for it. I would see through it right away.
You don't like me, Shane.
Yeah, okay.
Do you?
All right. Yeah. So,
all right. Well, anyway, that's a story about the old CIA operative Ma. Here's Cameron with Hey Ma, just the beginning, though. I probably should have done this ad while I was talking about being shearing like a baby, because it's from manscaped.com. If you want to get rid of all that pesky hair, you don't have to have a second puberty, my friends. You just have to go to Manscaped and get the Lawnmower 3.0, which is a premium electric trimmer that's designed to give you the confidence boost that you need. Let me ask you a question, because we have two folks with a beard, or three folks that's had a beard. Well, maybe four from time to time for Kate on the show.
Dude, that was also mean.
She's very open about waxing her mustache, right, Kate?
Thank you, Jess. Yes,
yeah, but
I
it's
am.
Different when she says it.
Oh, my apologies to Kate and to all the other lady listeners that we have on the show. I need to ask you a question to all three of you, I guess. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's gross to shave your beard or trim your beard with the same trimmer that you use on your balls? Kate, we'll start with you.
Yes, I do. That's why I have two separate ones, chaps. One for my face and one for my balls.
Those big old balls. Those big old Philly balls.
Right.
I too find that to be disgusting.
Kyle?
It's hair. It's my hair. It doesn't matter. I'll use the same one. I'm a simple man.
Yeah, but your butthole's near there.
Your butthole's near everywhere.
I don't put it on my butthole, Kate. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
I do.
I'm sorry. That just reminds me.
You guys don't care about... Okay, well, guys don't have to worry... No, I don't have a hairy butthole, first of all.
Let the record show indicate.
That just reminded me of forgetting Sarah Marshall, and the guy's like, why did God put a dumpster near a playground?
Uh-huh. All right.
He has a good point. But I used it yesterday. It was fantastic. It trimmed so neatly. I mean, my facial hair, my beard... It's basically like a Brillo pad. These things, it chops through it, no problem. Doesn't send hair flying around the bathroom like I've had before. I've had other trimmers that whenever I trim my mustache or anything, little shards. That might be where the banana-induced pink eye. It might just be from beard shards. I haven't had it since I've been using the Lawnmower 3.0. They also have the Shears 2.0, which is a luxury four-piece nail kit. If you need to clean up those cuticles before Labor Day, make sure you're doing that. And they have the Crop Preserver, which will... that's an anti-chafing ball deodorant moisturizer. So it'll have that summer sump ass a little bit mitigated.
Huge proponent here, and so is Cardi B. Clean your fucking balls, everyone, for the love of God. Maybe we don't want to go down on you because you got stink balls, but we don't want to tell you. Use this stuff on your balls, please. Thank you.
Or in the words of longtime stoolie Cardi B, it might be because your dick smells like mustard.
Right. So fix it.
All right. Let's move on to round number 5, which is going to be an interview that Cons did with Daniel Rodriguez. Cons, tell us a little bit about old Daniel.
Yeah, so real quick, behind the scenes, chaps, you were originally supposed to do this interview, and then you had something come up, and you texted me and said, hey, can you take this interview? And I remembered earlier in the week, you said, it's some guy from the movie The Outpost who plays himself, and I didn't think anything of it, and you said the name Daniel Rodriguez, and I still didn't think anything of it. And then I looked up the gentleman, and it clicked in my head that I knew who he was, because I had remembered the story from when he was at Clemson that they had done prior to one of his games about being in the Army prior to being a walk-on at Clemson, and I got very excited because I remembered that story, mm-hmm. and I remember being really moved by it, by the fact that he was so resilient and went from in the Army to walking on at Clemson.
What position did he play?
He was receiver and primarily a punt returner. Okay. And he'll tell you more in the interview, but he did get a shot in the league. He was with the Rams, and I believe it was the season the Rams were on Hard Knocks, and he got a concussion in the final game. Honestly, if he didn't get that concussion, there's a better than good chance he would have made the team. But because he was out for so many weeks, they had to replace him because he was like a fringe guy anyway. All that said, it was a very fascinating interview. Chaps, he described him somewhat as a Forrest Gump, and he really is, and just very interesting. So here's the interview with Daniel Rodriguez. All right, joining us now on Zero Blog 30 is veteran football player, actor, author, Daniel Rodriguez. Daniel, welcome to Zero Blog 30.
Appreciate y'all having me. Thank you. Thank you.
Absolutely. So I know I rambled through a lot of different titles there, and hopefully we will get to each one of those. But I think your journey starts with you joining the Army, and we're roughly the same age. I'm a few years older than you. And there's I think a lot of times there's a lot of overlap in people our age and why they join the Army. But why is it that you joined the Army?
Man, that's there's a culmination of things. I grew up in Virginia, kind of a unique town in Stafford, Virginia. My father was the athletic director at Quantico. So I kind of grew up in a very military-esque environment. My father was a veteran. And upon graduating, I barely graduated. I forged 90% of my report cards. I was a very kind of mischievous kid. Extremely intellectual, just didn't try in school. I never liked school. I would cut the edges. I tried as hard as I could to do the bare minimum and barely get by. My parents were going through a separation. So I really didn't have guidance or people to keep tabs on me at all times going through. So I was just kind of a good kid, polite, got bare minimum grades to stay eligible and forged everything else. Well, my dad died 4 days after I graduated and all my friends were going off to 4-year universities and my outlet thinking I was going to go to a community college or what have you, my father was going to have to pay that tuition. I grew up not privileged, but both my parents were working, middle class. So the opportunity for me to go to a higher education was there. And when my dad died, it was just an open, a wound being exposed. Like, you're not qualifying to go to school. Nobody's going to pay for you. And you're going to look like a moron because, you put yourself in this position, messing around over the last 4 years. So when I joined, I'm very, we were during a time of war during 2006, the Bush administration, and it was very hot. And, I came from a very patriotic background and kind of that influence, but I didn't join out of patriotism at that time in my life. I joined because I was a screw up. And it was an outlet out for me. So it looks as something like mature and responsible that people weren't going to criticize me for. I was going to get my GI Bill out of it, go to school. And at the same time, I felt like people would be respectful or there would be a respect of what I was doing with my life at that moment. And the military was an outlet. So I literally, 4 days after I graduated, buried my dad. A week later, I was in a recruiter station in Fort Lee, MEPS, maybe 2 weeks later. And that day I had signed up infantry, and within 48 hours I was heading down to Fort Benning, Georgia, upon graduating. So I was like, bam, 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 right into it. And then deployed shortly after to my first tour of Iraq. So
yeah,
the synopsis in there.
So I'm very sorry to hear about the loss of your father. I'm sure he was a great deal of inspiration for you in your life. Did you have any conversations with him about joining the military prior to his passing?
Yeah, I did. My father didn't know his father. So he grew up, a very hardworking dad. And, he was an amazing father figure. And he always would tell me, he was like, if you join the military, get a trade out of it. Don't be like me. He went infantry. And he was like, nobody told me otherwise. He enlisted his first day of his senior year in high school because the draft was still going on. Mm-hmm. So he had incentive to enlist before he graduated high school to go in as an E3 with more pay. So my dad was kind of just like a leap in the wind, lost. And he would tell me, get a trade out of it. Don't go infantry. And so hard-headed and cut from the same cloth, I ended up going infantry and when I enlisted. So other than that small talk, it was just, I think he wanted me to go to school and not have to go down the same road he did. But I know that, I was influenced by that. He used to watch war movies and, always we were pro-military in my house. He was a staff sergeant in the Army. So he was stationed in Europe and jumped out of plane. So as a kid, you romanticize and look up to your father. And
mm-hmm.
He'd play, manhunt in the backyard. I would wear his camis and stuff like that. So just as a kid, I was storming the beaches of Normandy after Saving Private Ryan. I watched that. So I think there was just like this draw when my outlet didn't work out in school or I was kind of exposed, there was always that draw to what I thought was going to probably be my future regardless, which was footsteps of my father. So
yeah,
played out to where I think my life was supposed to end up.
I mean, I think, and I appreciate your honesty, because so many people will have the old blood and guts, the American patriotism story, all romantic, when in fact you just told it like it was. And to your credit, to kind of, you know, mess around and not put forth a lot of effort into your schoolwork, but still be able to graduate, I think that takes more intelligence than you're giving yourself credit for. So kudos to you on that.
I got to tell you the side story. My best friend and I, we would forge our report cards. And this was like when you would have, you know, Windows 96 paint, you know, scan it, paint, like copy and paste. We got so good at it. We forged his driver's license and we were driving 6 months earlier. So I agree. Like if I would have put half as much effort into my schoolwork as I did forging, what my parents saw at the end of the day, I probably would have been in a good position, but you know, it all worked out. So,
all right. Well, that I'm glad that it worked out. Okay. So you mentioned you decided, all right, I'm going to go infantry, despite the better judgment of maybe learning a trade, I'm going to go be a grunt, and you find yourself in Iraq. And where were you in Iraq and what were you doing there?
I was in Sadr City. So I was in Baghdad.
Right in the heart of shit.
In the heart of shit in 2006 Bush administration. So I mean, it was known as a surge.
And, yep.
And I have to like take a step back, because I admitted to smoking marijuana going into MEPS, and I qualified for satellite communications. You know, my ASVAB was actually top of the charts in terms of what I could pick. And I
see,
and
I told you, you're smart.
Yeah, for sure. No, thank you. No, so that's a proof. Yeah. So I admitted to smoking weed one time. And they dropped my security clearance since it was within the last 6 months. And they told me I had to wait 6 months to reinstate for the Fort Huachuca listing I had just gotten. And I was like, well, no, I'm getting that. Like, my dad's dead. Like, I'm not going back home without, you know, whatever, whatever. And I got to say, tell people I lost my security clearance because of weed. I was like, damn, like, what do you have? She had to put in a phone call to give me infantry. And she, I'll never forget, it was this, you know, this black lady at Fort Mepps. She's nails done. She goes, you do know we're at the time of war, don't you? And I was like, yes, ma'am. And she's like, okay. And like, just, I was like, it'll always stick with me. She goes, you do realize we're at a time of war, don't you? I was like, okay, I guess like we are, just an 18-year-old kid. So yeah, that's how I ended up going infantry. 2 days later, I was in Fort Benning, Georgia within 72 hours, Sadr City, 20 days after graduating. I did a 7-day like reinforcement. And a soldier was killed in my unit, and I ended up being a replacement soldier. So as soon as I graduated basic, I was boots on the ground within a month in Baghdad.
Wow. I mean, that's pretty quick. I mean, for those who aren't aware, typically in the Army, you get to a unit and you have some time to train up. Maybe you go to JRTC or NTC rotation to kind of get ready for whatever it is you're going to go do downrange. So for you to come in, how much of a challenge was that to join a unit that had already been working together, already been training together, knows one another, knows their tendencies, and here you are, fresh out, and you don't know anybody?
It was difficult to adjust. And as you know, platoons have different, just, you know, the dichotomies all over the place. And I had it the worst with, you know, cherries or privates that had gone through the duration in garrison of being heckled and, you know, hazed. And here I showed up in theater and they couldn't mess with me like that. They're like, no, we have mission, it's priority. So I had a lot of animosity towards younger guys of my same rank that I didn't really have to go through that garrison life. And I also had a very peculiar like environment because I was replacing one of their best friends. Like I was sleeping in the bunk that they just had this guy that they went through JRTC and NTC. And that was their buddy for, you know, the first 2 months of deployment. And he got killed very early on, and we still had a year left, and then we got orders to extend. So for the first few months, it was kind of difficult for me. And I think my nature, like my personality and nature in general, is a very people person. Like I try to not to be awkward. I try to be very, like, you know, just charismatic. And I think it's difficult for soldiers sometimes to, you know, especially platoons, to kind of open up to a new guy when they're not really sure what's going to happen, you know, tomorrow, and they just lost their good friend. So, you know, I had a great platoon at the end of it. You know, my deployment ended up, you know, becoming tight, and I ended up bonding, and I went to Afghanistan with them as well. But it was weird. It was weird to go through it. I mean, I went out on mission. Literally, I landed on the Black Hawk touches down, sleeping on a cot. Next morning, I wake up, and they're like, hey, we need you to go out, blah, blah. And before I go out, 45 minutes, my staff or section sergeant, his name's Barella, he's like, look, man, he's got a pen and paper. He's like, look, man, I got to know something about you, because if you died, I don't know what the hell to tell your parents. Like, they're my rifle. I'm like, you know, tell them my name, like where I'm from, what I'm about. He's like, all right, man. He's like, do you not a gun? You know, type, just like very like, he's like, do you not a gun? You want dismount? He's like, do you prefer? He's like, we can put you on the 50 or the 240, blah, blah. I was like, you know, I prefer the 240. And I was in a gun. I was gunning truck going down Sadr City in Baghdad within 36 hours of being, you know, leaving. So,
I mean, that's wild, dude. I mean, of all the scenarios you could get thrown into, brand new, Sadr City, don't know anybody, I really commend you for that. I didn't realize it was like that for you. So, I mean, you're going through the surge. You go through a lengthy 15-month deployment. That was when we were still doing 15-month deployments. And thankfully, you come home from that deployment, and you redeployed to where?
Afghanistan. So my unit, when we came home, we had orders pretty much already to go back to Afghanistan. We knew we were going to go back. So we had a year of downtime. And what was beneficial for me deploying so early is I came back already a specialist. So I had deployment time. I had like knocked out some stuff, like my PT score. So I had actually, I was in a really good position to fast track when I was in the Army. So that's how I made rank so fast and quickly. Mm-hmm. I deployed and had so much deployment time under my belt before I was like, I had 27 months deployed and only 21 months of garrison in my 48 months of Army
life. Wow.
So my 4 years, I had more time deployed than I did stateside. Crazy.
That's not common. So that's unbelievable.
And I was stop loss.
Jeez Louise. Wow. Okay. All right. So you're with 10th Mountain. Is that correct?
Fourth ID in second ID in Iraq, and then we reflagged a fourth ID in Afghanistan. So my unit came from Korea.
They went okay.
to Iraq, but they were in Ramadi, and they went from Ramadi straight to Fort Carson, Colorado. And then we deployed from Carson to Iraq, came back as second ID, reflagged a fourth ID, still in Carson, and then went as fourth ID to Afghanistan. And came back. So now fourth ID is in Carson still, I believe.
Yes, yeah, so that's correct. So actually, funny enough, I was at Fort Hood and I was fourth ID. We got reflagged the first Cav, and fourth ID went to Fort Carson, which ultimately was fourth ID for you. So kind of, you know, small world there. So you go to Afghanistan, and I guess we'll just jump right to the heart of the discussion here. You, October 3rd, 2009. Actually, I'm sorry. Let's take a step back. You deployed to Afghanistan, and where is it that you went to in Afghanistan?
It was the Nuristan province. So it was, I mean, the Swat Valley-esque, you know, on the Pakistan border. It was pretty hot. So we came in, I think, to Kandahar, whichever one it is. And then our little operating base that we would, like, refit or was called Bostik. And then we went from Bostik, and it was another 45-minute Chinook ride into the mountains in the Hindu Kush Mountains where our outpost was at, extremely isolated. And it was called Combat Outpost Keating, and it was Nuristan province, like I said, right on the Pakistan border. You know, it was just a very isolated position, and extremely different from what I had been used to in Iraq, in terms of just like, you know, Humvee rolling around, IEDs, you know, sniper fire, you know, just EFP type shit. I can cuss, right? Is that okay?
Absolutely.
EFP type shit. And it's just like, you know, so it was just a completely different world. You know, I don't, to kind of give you an infrastructure on the base, when I landed in the Chinook, it was completely black in the valley, but when the sun came up, it was just, we were at the bottom of three mountains, and we had been told that the strategic location was a little bit, you know, not to our favor, but we didn't realize how crazy the terrain was out there. And I mean, we were literally just looking up, facing up. Every time we would get in contact, it was always looking up and always firing. So when we first got there, it was pretty hectic, and I felt like we were always on our toes, you know, from the get-go. So 5 months in comes October 3rd. So,
yeah. And kind of a dubious date in Army history. I don't know, for those who know, October 3rd is the same day that the Battle of Mogadishu took place. And that did not go as planned for us either. So October 3rd, hey, any leaders out there listening, maybe don't plan shit on October 3rd going forward. We appreciate that. So what happened on October 3rd?
Since I would say, about August, September, we would start getting just our ICOM chatter back and forth, and our linguists would intercept, and, you know, they'd be talking. They would say, hey, we're intercepting 300 Taliban forces are mounting up to overrun Combat Outpost Keating. and we would all like mount up on our weapons, and we were getting hit 3 to 4 times a week regardless. Like pretty much every other morning, you could clockwork in the morning, we'd get rockets of small arms. At night, right before we go to bed, they'd just be fucking with us. And so we would always get ICOM chatter like, oh, we killed 3 Americans. And it was all just BS. So we were just like, crying wolf, they're crying wolf. And, you know, I would say about a week out from October, we got like 2 more reports. They're like, no, you know, and our linguist is like, you know, they're mounting up, removed, blah, blah, blah. And we're just looking out and nothing, you know, nothing. And so I wake up on October 3rd, 2009, and it was my responsibility to go get some food in the morning for my guys up in the mortar pit because I was actually attached to a Cav Scout unit. So I was infantry. My specialty was a mortar. Like, so when I got to Carson, they attached me as a mortarman to a cavalry scout unit. So I had a sniper rifle and a mortar in a mortar pit in Afghanistan. Like I loved it. I wasn't even attached to the cav unit. Like I was.
So you're kind of doing your own thing, kind of just enjoying it.
I had, you know, 10,000 rounds of ammo at any given time, just be rocking. We had our own AT-4. Oh, it was sick. Anyway. Another time. So thankfully I had all that shit up there. So I go down with a pistol and nothing in my hand because I have to get food. And I'm on the satellite computer, like, you know, just, you know, writing emails home. We had one satellite communication thing. And these rockets just start coming in. And immediately I kind of had a feeling. I was like, all right, this is pretty, pretty bad. And then you kind of have just the recollection of, like, mounting up soldiers, whatever, whatever. But it's just another day in Afghanistan getting hit. But it was about a solid 10, 15 seconds of just, like, steady RPGs, and then I knew it was like, all right, this is gonna be might be hectic. My first impression though, when I ran out, like I had charged my 9mm, I come running out, like, and I just see like specks where my run's at, and I really couldn't put 2 and 2 together, like how on top of us the fighters were, you know, because it's one thing to shoot RPGs from a distance or, you know, whatever, mortars, you just kind of walk them in. But I had the thought, I was like, I don't remember it raining because it looked like just rain speckle. And I just like kind of run through. And as soon as I run through, I feel like just this like little bite in my shin, and a rock had hit up from whatever round had hit the ground, had shot a rock up and hit me right in my shin. And then it clicked on me. I was like, oh shit, these are bullets. Like these are bullets hitting the ground. Like, and then I just didn't stop. Like I just.
And you had experienced incoming fire to that point. That wasn't anything new.
Oh yeah. Not anything new, but I had not experienced like bullet fire,
right?
Like, so you have indirect and you have some small arms here and there, AKs, but you know, it's pretty distant. This shit was right on top of me. Like, I mean, it was like a constant flow. That's why I thought it was raining at first. Like it was, the ground was like literally just like kind of being like hit, and I ran right through it. And as soon as I like pinched, I knew exactly what was going on. And that's when I looked up and I just saw muzzle flash coming down the switchback. I mean, just like as far as I could see. And all I had was my 9mm, and I just like just started running and just shooting, and I was yelling because I had about 150, 200 meter run uphill, not like drastically uphill, but like it was an incline, and I had
enough to tire you out.
Hell yeah! Luckily in the mountains though, like it was pretty isolated, so we didn't have anybody AR-670-1ing us. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
I had PT shorts on, tennis shoes, this little flak vest, a helmet, and a pistol. So thankfully, I was in the best position to run, not fight, but just to run. Like I was very low weight, lightweight, and I had to run. So I ran my ass, and I was the only one to make it through the fight that day to like to the fighting position. So there's this 50 cal going on, and I'm just yelling friendly. I ended up taking the RPG, blew me into this Humvee, and I tell people to like the when I knew like it was really like not, I mean, I knew it was getting bad, but I just had this moment, like kind of like sitting like down, like fucking scared shit, like figuring out. And you know, those like games at the like Chuck E. Cheese or whatever, like there's coins and like the slot machine kind of pushes the coins.
Yes.
I was like looking up at my friend who I thought it was Mace, my buddy Mace, but it was another guy, Larson. They had switched guards when I was down, so I didn't know. And I just kind of look up at this 50 cal and I just see these 50 shell can am like the 50 shells, 50, the 50 cal shells just like pushing off this truck and like coming down. And I was just like this moment, I was like, holy like fuck, like this shit is like this 50 cal is rocking this hard coming down. Like I've just been blown up, who knows, like rock. And I just like, all right, this is bad. And I just ran right underneath, like, because I had to get to my machine gun still. And as soon as I get to my position, it felt like forever, but it was probably maybe 90 seconds. You know, this ordeal is maybe 93 minutes, maybe. And I run up and I'm hiding behind a HESCO barrier, like catching my breath and completely out of ammo. And my buddy Thompson, he's like my best friend. He like comes out and he looked at me and like, you know, when you don't really say anything, but you just know the situation. He like I could see it in his face where he was like, oh shit, this is bad. And as soon, before I could even like say switchbacks where the guys were coming down, he was already running to his gun. And he just got like this boom. I didn't even see it. I saw it, but I didn't see it because all I saw was his rifle, like just hit the ground, like just rifle just hit. And then when I looked up to see what it was, he fell. And so I knew like pretty squared away what had probably happened, and turned him over, and he had been hit in the head, like pretty bad. And then I just started spraying. I just started unloading my machine gun, 240. And just hunkered down. We were just getting hit so crazy. It ended up being about an 18-hour firefight. Wow. I threw 30 to 40 hand grenades. I was trying to claim wars. We were killing in and around our wire. Like, it was nuts. We killed about 100 in our compound and outside of it, like stacked. So when they say overrun, it was fucking overrun. Like, me and another guy breeding were hunched down. Comms were completely taken out. We didn't really know where anybody was at. I was isolated in my point. LRAS 2 or two other buddies were isolated. And out of that, 8 Americans ended up dying that day. A ninth one, I always say ninth one died later. He committed suicide shortly after he got home. And then we had 2 Medal of Honor recipients and kind of came out as one of the most decorated units of all time. So it's a pretty documented fight now. There's a movie out about it. So it's kind of, ideal for me to just tell people, yeah, you go check that out.
So you don't have to relive it each time. And you kind of briefly mentioned, but it was Staff Sergeant Clint Romiche and Staff Sergeant Ty Carter. And they've actually both been guests on this show. Tremendous, extraordinary gentlemen. And obviously very heroic what they did that day. I just have to think, though, you kind of touched on a little bit the terrain at which Cop Keating was situated. I think I just would have been nervous just every day, because obviously it's a pretty basic principle. You want the high ground, and you guys didn't have the high ground anywhere around you. So what was it like? I mean, again, and you can speak freely here, because I know enlisted guys like to have choice words about officers. You were probably thinking, who's the fucking idiot who thought this was a good place for a cop with all these mountains and advantageous positions for the enemy around us?
Yeah, no, it was absolutely stupid in my opinion. Absolutely. But I think it goes down to, you know, lessons learned. And unfortunately, the outcome of, you know, this lesson is horrific and tragic in some regard. But I think as Americans in our military, we are extremely confident, as we should be, right? And so I think we get complacent in times, just like anything else, whether it's a high ground, whether it's a low ground. I think there was a sister cop called Fritchie above us that we couldn't even see, but it was supposed to be our protector. And I think just kind of how those cops were lined out there, it was a very piss poor job in strategically aligning it, and things were kind of put down. And I think that our military ego of suppressing with indirect and our flight, you know, really left us vulnerable, because at the end of the day, when they were right up on us, it showed exactly what, you know, our weakness was, is
right.
Strategic advantage. We couldn't support ourselves indirectly, and it made for an absolute catastrophe in our military history. So, yeah, I think it's a compound of egos and people just plotting shit on maps and never going down there to check it out themselves. You know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of things that 2 letters of reprimands were handed down to our officers after this fight. So,
yeah, I mean, there was a large investigation, as there is anytime any round is fired. But something to this magnitude, there was a large investigation, and then it was found that there was a significant lack of judgment executed by the chain of command there. So understandable why you are none too pleased. But okay, so you come out of this battle, not unscathed, mind you. You were injured in the battle.
Yes.
And
both legs and a bullet fragment through the back of my shoulder that went through, and then shrapnel on my neck too.
And mind you, you continued to fight with all that shrapnel in your body.
Fuck, I had to, mate.
I know. No, absolutely. No, I just think it needs to be called out that you did that. It's like you had shrapnel, and it wasn't, hey, coach, take me out, I'm all set for the day. You continue to fight.
Hell yeah, man. Hell no. It's kill or be killed. So I wasn't going out without a fight. It was twice. I went out to go try to drag my buddy in at first. It was the first time I got hit. And the second time was going out to just go out and shoot. Soon as I went out, another RPG came in. And so we were pinned down. So, but I fought through the wounds, and I knew other people would, or I mean, they already killed my friend. So I was pretty set. I thought I was going to die. Like, you know, I wasn't telling myself, when is it going to happen? It was just more or less, I was comfortable in the moment that, fuck it. I know it can happen now. And I think you just kind of, for me, it was just take as many out before they take you out, you know, be smart. It was a wild, wild day for sure.
Yes, you certainly epitomize everything it is to be a team player and a true friend to all those battle buddies next to you. So you come out of that battle, and what does the remainder of your deployment look like in Afghanistan after that battle?
So I had 5 months left, man. 5 months left of my deployment. So it was shit. But we ended up blowing the base completely up as best as they could. JTAC came in. We were out within 72 hours. I mean, it looked like Armageddon. Everything was on fire. Our chow hall, dining facilities, the majority of us left the COP with only what we had on our back. Everything else had been destroyed. So I had my rifle, whatever I was wearing, you know, it is nuts. So I had to go back to Bostic. We had a month of reintegration, and then I was back out on missions doing patrols again for the last 5 months. And that was probably the hardest part was like kind of going back into the mix again and like having, I don't know, like I had gone through up and downs, and you've seen your memorial services and shit, you know, like you lose buddies. But I think going through something like that full on, and then knowing like, okay, I still got 5 months left. Like, you know, usually it's over. You think like, okay, I just endured that shit. I'm done. Let me go get a cigarette. I'm going to go call it quits.
And yep.
No, the job still goes. And that was tough. That was tough to try to keep like a facade, like, you know, your soldier type shit.
I mean, you could be the toughest guy to ever put on army boots, but to have to endure an additional 5 months after going through that battle, which is, you know, widely known throughout the army, everybody knows about that battle. So I commend you for that. But so you get through that next 5 months, you're getting ready to come home. How did you transition out of the army? And I believe there was a promise made to somebody in terms of what you were going to do next.
So yeah, Thompson, my friend that was killed, we would just like chat all the time, and kind of like going back to how we started, you know, you realize when you're in the mountaintops and kind of seeing shit like that and friends die in third world countries, what opportunities you had and, you know, what you kind of let go. And I would always just recall my last high school football game in the playoffs, like crying in the locker room as a senior, like, you know, with the guys, knowing that that's probably your last game you'll ever play to some, you know, competitive nature. And I think Afghanistan and Iraq, for that matter, really opened my eyes of like, look, you know, my GI Bill is going to be paid for. I have all my eligibility. I'm in shape. And if I miss it that much and I think about that last game every single day over here, then it means I still want to go back and play it. And my dream as a kid was always to play in the NFL and always, you know, to be a professional athlete of some sort. So we would just like, me and Thompson would go back and forth of what we wanted to do. And I was like, yo, when I do this, when I get out of here, I'm going to go back, use my GI Bill, walk on somewhere and earn a scholarship. And he would just say, you know, promise me. That was always his thing. Yeah, all right, promise me. Do it. Promise me. And I would kind of like beat around the bush if I wasn't serious. And one day I was like, all right, man, I promise you, I'm going to go play. And he just kind of looked at me and he's like, all right, man, I'd be badass if you do that. And that was kind of the moment. And then 2 weeks later, some shortly time after that, he was killed. It was Keating. So I just kind of had that. It wasn't right away. It wasn't, I won't say, like, I came back with this, like, you know, Rambo down the street and put my duffel bag down. I was like, next chapter. You know, no, I, you know, fucking had a pistol in my mouth at one point. I had a 4 month stint of when I got out of the army and I had to wait for my GI Bill to kick in January. So I admit that entire, like, semester, like, I was going crazy, you know, I'm back home, like in my high school room, and everything's the same, but everything's not the same, like just shit, you know, just wild shit. So it was a rough road. And thankfully, you know, I started getting involved with a group called Team RWB.
Sure.
It was a focus on kind of being outdoors and kind of, you know, focusing on therapeutic and recreation. And that kind of got the wheels turning and the ideas going again, like, hey, I can really devote myself to getting in shape and going after that dream and getting my associates and transferring to a four-year university and keeping my promise. And that was kind of the steps of the motion of what ultimately came. But yeah, that promise was set there.
Okay. But so, you know, it's not as if you, so now you're 4 years removed from your last high school football game, give or take, right? 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, more or less, 4 or 5, yeah.
And I don't know if you had a tape coming out of high school, but what was the process of just ultimately you ended up at Clemson, but what was the process of getting to Clemson? Because I don't know, in case anyone's checked the last 10, 15 years, Clemson's had a pretty decent team, and they don't just take anybody. So talk me through that process.
Yeah, so I started working out, and I remember watching this video. I would work out every morning, and the intent was get your associate's degree, get that, and then transfer to a 4-year university. And I would watch this video, and I can't remember, it was on that ET path, that ET page, the guy, and it was like, if you want to succeed as bad as you want to breathe. And it's this guy like working out for football at East Carolina, like, you know, jumping in the water. And I would watch this video every single morning before I go work out. And I would start seeing like high school highlights and all this shit going on by kids getting recruited. And I started getting really, really good shape. And my friends were like, why don't you make a recruitment video? And I was like, you know, my high school highlights are 5 years old. Like, who the hell wants to see it? But my friend was like, look, man, like, you got a pretty remarkable story. I think these college coaches would be willing to like see that you weren't just, you know, sticking around for the last 4 years, that you were doing something honorable. And, you know, if you're coming as a walk-on with your GI Bill, it might be opportunistic for you to just put yourself out there.
And yeah, so I think it's important to mention, you didn't just get, obviously you're very talented, but I get perturbed when people say, oh, that guy got a shot because he was a veteran and the coach just thought they'd give him a shot just because they liked him. It's like, you had proven toughness. You had leadership in the face of adversity. You had combat. You had all of these characteristics and experiences that 18-year-olds don't have, and you can't teach them those things. Those can be so valuable to a team. So anyone who ever says like, oh, he just got a shot out of pity, bullshit. That's not the case. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, absolutely. You're spot on. And like, I think that was credible because I was a decent football player. You know, I was a 2-time all AAU champion in basketball. Like I had a Division III offer in football. My grades weren't good enough. So I could ball. Like I was an athlete. So it wasn't like this shot in the dark. Mm-hmm. Like Clemson, you know, they're recruiting down the pipeline and your walk-ons are getting beat up in practice, which is great. Like, give me my opportunity. I'll take it. And so kind of like when I was putting that foot forward and kind of went out there, Coach Sweeney said exactly what you said. He was like, listen, son, I don't know if you can catch a pass, but I know I want you in my locker room. You have the intangible skills that, you know, maturity, a factor of, you know, inspiration potentially. And so I think he saw me as a more valuable key to the team than just the X's and O's, because obviously, you know, I wasn't a 5-star recruit. So,
yeah, I mean, Jesus, if I'm a freshman or sophomore on that team and I see you during spring workouts and we're doing a workout and I'm kind of dogging it and I see you and I'm like, well, there's the guy who just got shot up in Iraq and Afghanistan and he's crushing it. So maybe I should stop dogging it so much and get my ass in gear. That's the type of thing you look for out of players like you. And then it turned out, though, that you know, obviously were a good athlete. You got yourself on the field.
Yeah, no, it was twofold, because I think I did bring that aspect to the team where – perfect example, one of my good buddies that I play with, his name's Grady Jarrett. He plays for the Atlanta Falcons. He's a DT, defensive tackle, nose. I mean, he's a freak. He's an animal. He just signed an amazing contract. And he could absolutely snap me in half if he wanted to. And one day in the locker room, we were just messing around. And I just whipped him around, you know, some ground fighting techniques. And I put him in an arm bar that absolutely just blew his mind. And I had, like, this reputation in the locker room. Like, oh, don't fuck with Danny. That's G.I. Joe. Fuck you. And I had, like, the respect of, like, every 6'6", like, defensive end, like, walking. Because, mm-hmm. like, they knew I had an edge about me. And, like, even though, like, you know, they could break me over their knee more or less, like, they knew I was a fighter. Like, they knew I was going to go down with them. So I definitely know that I brought that energy. And it was cool because you would see people down or had messed up a play. And I'd go over there and be like, hey, man, I've seen friendly fire kill a buddy. Get over it. Move on.
Yeah.
And it's just like you kind of give them those tidbits of perspective of where they're at in that moment and like hopefully give them an opportunity to look at it and be like, okay, you know, let me move on. That's leadership type shit, right?
So, absolutely. Absolutely. Like, and you obviously proved that to have that in spades. But then how do you go from being, you know, mostly a special teams guy, and that's coming from mostly a special teams guy, so I don't say that disparagingly. How do you get invited to an NFL camp?
Man, so it kind of lined up. Even as a kid, I knew I wanted a shot at the NFL. I knew I didn't know how I was going to get there, and as things started rolling and I get to Clemson, my official visit was on the pro day of the following class. So, like, I was about to – it was spring ball. I was about to come in. I was being recruited and talking to them. And I got there right before the spring game, and I saw all the seniors stand in front in the team room, all 32 NFL scouts, and they grill them with questions. They say, what's your three best games? What positions can you play? Boom, boom, boom. And they're just answering all these questions. So I sat through this duration, and then I saw them run their 40s, do all their things. So in the back of my head, I was thinking to myself, I was like, oh, man, like, as soon as I step on the field, it's a resume. Like, I got to every day, because you see these scouts at practice. They're sitting there. They have a room designed that says on the tab, and it'll say wide receivers, defensive, NFL scouts. And they're in there watching film from a spring game 6 years ago of you or whatever. Like, and so it was really clicked into me. It was like, okay, I might not ever see the field on game time, but they're going to watch my film. They're going to watch my practice. They're going to watch every single scrimmage. So I just took it upon myself is that I needed to go out and just ball every day. So I luckily played for an also good team that we were up a lot in the second half. So I had some decent stats, and I was second leading punt returner for 3 years. And, you know, when you have DeAndre Hopkins, Sammy Watkins, Martavis Bryant, Adam Humphries, and Deshaun Watson kind of in that tier of lineage, it was really cool for me to showcase my skills and kind of make the most of it. And when I had my chance to stand in front of those NFL teams, my coaches didn't believe me that I was actually going to do my pro day. They're like, I'm like, hell yeah, I'm doing my pro day. Like, I'm going to do that. And I, like, stood in front of all 32 teams. I listed all my games. I told them which practices to watch. I told them what positions I was playing, like, all that stuff. And, like, boom, 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 listed it. And I ended up getting a call from the Redskins and the Rams after the draft. So that's kind of how it, like, fell into place.
Yeah, and you say it so nonchalantly, but that to list off some of those names at quarterback, and you're obviously going to be on some film. So, I mean, it's just very advantageous that you were able to make the team at Clemson. And so you end up with the Rams, and what happened from there?
Yeah, so I was undrafted trial. And to point on that, like, my freshman year coming in, we had a guy named Chad Kelly as well, who was Chad Kelly, Deshaun Watson. So my, like, scout year, like, I was a leading receiver for our spring game going in my freshman year. I was actually balling. Like, I was having a really like time going in. So every game for me was like bread and butter. So when I went to that NFL thing, I made sure I was like, no, you need to look at spring game 2000, whatever, like, boom, boom, like me and Deshaun. And so, yeah, so the Rams called me, and their tryout was on, I don't know the dates, but their tryouts were on the 1st. And then the Redskins tryouts was on, say, the 8th, like a week after. And how it works is you can go to any tryouts you're invited to and jump around until you sign or make your decision. Well, I only had two teams call me. So I went for a two-day tryout to St. Louis. It was last year in St. Louis. It was Todd Gurley's draft class. I get there. I have a really good tryout. I had this one-on-one play against Janoris Jenkins where I just kind of, like, broke it off just right and had a really good clean catch. And what also helped me is Tavon Austin hadn't made it through – I don't think a preseason or a regular season healthy in like 3 or 4 years. And his primary thing was slot and punt returner. And so I was by far the best punt returner coming into that class, like, of anybody, like, even the veterans on the team. Tavon is another animal. Like, when he catches it, Tavon Austin is a game changer. I'm not saying that I'm better than him, but in terms of just like natural ability to field punts, you got to have it. You got to field punts. Like, it's a desire, and I'm a punt returner. Like, I love that. I salivate over knowing that I'm about to get that shit. That edge. So that was my in, and I had a really good 2 day camp, and they're like, hey, we want to sign you as an undrafted free agent, and I was like, you know, the Redskins offered me blah blah. And they're like, well, you can go to Washington and try,
right?
Or you can be a Ram right now. I was like, yeah, you got a pen.
I'll stick with you guys. That's a great idea. So where throughout this entire story did you decide, all right, I'm going to write a book? Because you wrote a book called Rise about your story, which obviously warrants a book being written. But at what point, where in the timeline does the book get written?
It was actually in college. So crazy enough, I was the first ever NCAA athlete granted permission to have representation and make money off my name while still in school. So my sophomore.
Oh.
Yeah, my sophomore year of college, freshman or sophomore year of college, Tom Rinaldi did a special on me. We were playing Virginia Tech. It would have been my freshman year. So I had a ton of recognition. This college game day piece went viral. And this was before, like, today's viral. This was like,
you know. Mm-hmm. No, I remember the story.
Yeah, so I had Tom Rinaldi ended up doing two pieces. Dan Rather ended up reaching out and did a special on me. So I had like all these different scales, and I wasn't on scholarship. I was using my GI Bill. So the sweet thing Coach Sweeney loved was that I was actually getting paid to go to school, and it left a scholarship slot open. So I was treated as a scholarship athlete, a scholarship player, but mm-hmm. I had to be on scholarship because I was on GI Bill. So all this is on. Oh yeah, yeah. What was the question?
When did you write the book?
That's right. So they came to me and they're like, hey, we'd like to offer you a book deal. And Clemson was the one that really was, that's when they started going through the process of like, okay, he's not on scholarship. Other student athletes can work and earn commission like this. They literally leveraged it in accordance to every guideline possible. And yeah, I was very adamant at first. I was like, no, I'm not going to do it. And one of my buddies who was killed, his mom found out, and she's like, Daniel, if you don't write this book, you'll be doing a disservice to people who need to hear your story and what you've endured and what you've gone through. And so I made it very clear. I was like, look, this isn't gonna be Disney shit. Like, this isn't Remember the Titans. Like, some real shit, and I gotta face my platoon buddies down the road, and they're gonna read this, and it's gonna be raw, and they're all about it. So I actually ended up writing a book my sophomore into junior year of college. I worked with a guy named Joe Layden who did Kobe Bryant's autobiography and Dwayne The Rock Johnson's autobiography. And so he was really talented. He flew into Clemson. We wrote it in the off season. And before I graduated my senior year, I was a published author, and I was actually going and speaking and coming back on like Wednesday and then playing on Saturday. So like my senior year was pretty hectic as like a student athlete. Like,
That's awesome. So, okay. So we have combat, we have college football, we have published author, and now fast forward to right now where there is a movie out with Scott Eastwood and Orlando Bloom, to name a few, called The Outpost, about your story. And oh, by the way, you're in it playing yourself. Where did that come from?
That was a bit serendipitous because I got a concussion the fourth preseason game. I was final cuts. Got a concussion against Kansas City. Ended up not getting cut. I thought I was going to get signed to P Squad. Had to wait 6 weeks for the concussion protocol. They ended up signing another guy. Blah blah blah. I get cut. I always enjoyed acting. It's, you know, I say this. I always want to be in the NFL. I've always wanted to be in the NFL. I've always wanted to act. I've always wanted to do music. Those were really things that I've always been drawn to. And when I ended up moving out to – I moved out to L.A. before I went to St. Louis. So I graduated Clemson, drove cross-country with my ex, started training at Exos, and then I was undrafted to the Rams, and then I got cut and the team moved to L.A. So I was just, like, in this bubble of networking. Like, I thought, you know, L.A., my agency was in L.A., my manager for my book was in L.A., so I had, like, all these draw cards to stay there. So what the fuck's LA known for? Like auditioning. So like I just started kind of getting in that realm. I ended up doing a Netflix original called Medal of Honor.
Mm-hmm.
Actually it's a 7-series mini-series, but it's each Medal of Honor winner, and two of them are Clint and Ty, my homie.
Yep.
So I was an extra because it was shot in LA. So I met all the directors. I was interviewed. Like if you watch it, I'm like interviewed for my actions. And then I'm actually an extra in another one. So that was like my breakthrough. So fast forward another year. I get a call from Jake Tapper, who wrote the book called The Outpost,
which yep.
The book is the adaptation. And he's like, hey, do you mind meeting up with the director and producer? They want to get your intake on The Outpost, blah, blah, blah. I ride my bike to this thing, to this interview in Manhattan Beach, and I'm chatting with this dude. We're having a good talk, like talking to him, boom, boom, boom. He's telling me all about it, budget, this shit. And I was like, well, who y'all got playing me? And he's like, oh, we haven't casted you yet. And I was like, well, fuck, man. What do you mean? I'm right here. Like, look no further. And
who knows how to play me better than me?
And he was a bit, I think he was skeptical at first, for sure, because at the end of the day, it's a multi-million-dollar budget with
international
sailing rights. And, you know, there's a lot at stake. So just throw in some kid. But I think they thought of it as like a selling point for sure. And like, okay, this can add authenticity. But bro, they ended up rewriting the entire script for me. I was only supposed to be out there for a week. I ended up staying an entire month. And yeah, they really enjoyed my acting ability, and it was cool. I had a really good connection on set with some of the guys, so it ended up being like a full month and a half shoot for me, which is really cool.
I mean, that's just so awesome, and obviously, I encourage everyone to see it because it's such a heroic day that you all displayed so much heroism fighting that day. What was it like, one, playing yourself, and two, did you feel a sense of responsibility? I'm assuming the answer is yes, to make sure that all these men portraying your buddies, your battle buddies, got it right.
Absolutely. Yes. And it was difficult because I think, like I kind of alluded to, I have made a career in something, and also I've made it a piece of me to share my experience in order for others to kind of hopefully benefit, right? That's my give and take right now with everything. When I speak and go talk to high school kids, I hope that they think of my friends or my journey when they're in a low place. So I've always had this ability to let people into my portal without it really damaging me that much. Well, when I was on set, I was like, I felt like what I had been kind of just masking really opened up the wounds that I hadn't really been treating. And going through it again was pretty hard. Like, you know, I mean, they rebuilt this base to a T. I mean, they had over 2,000 pictures from 10 years of deployments, TVs, radios, I mean, name tags, bunks, sleeping quarters. So like in their film, we're filming a war movie. So I'd be falling asleep and like waking up in the hoops that I really would wake up in. And like, I'd be having flashbacks and shit. So I actually had a pretty difficult time throughout doing it. That being said, after doing it and seeing the final result and kind of knowing the effort put in by the cast and crew and also the appreciation from the families, like, man, it was so much therapy and having it done now. Like, I feel like, again, like I don't really need to talk about it because people can kind of see what happened. And I think in that regard, you know, coming full circle, it was one of the coolest things, you know, checking off always wanted to do list in terms of playing in a movie. So yeah, it was an awesome experience. I'm really grateful for and happy, but in the moment it was hard as shit to do. It was kind of difficult. I mean, you're reenacting and trying to tell your director how your friend died.
Yeah.
You know, they're doing makeup and trying to get it into the service. I want it to be as real as possible. I want people to, you know, be there. That's what I did it for. I wasn't going to sugarcoat it again. So it was tough, but at the end of it, I walked away and I just felt like relieved. Like, damn, like, okay, I had a chance to kind of go back and make sure my friends are never forgotten. Like, you know, this is something that's going to hopefully last a very long time, and people will know my buddies who sacrificed all, and guys like Ty and Clint, you know, what they did. So, I feel rewarded to have been part of it now.
That's just so awesome, and I respect the hell out of you for having the courage to go back and to relive that. And I'm happy to hear that it was helpful in allowing you to get the help you needed and kind of move past that in your life, and not necessarily move past it and forget it, but to just be able to deal with that. So I think it really is such a great thing. Did they get it right?
Yeah, for sure. Like some of the like the timeline is
sure
Hollywood doc, but in terms of like personality and kind of atmosphere and like I think they really did a good job, and that's not being biased. Like, you know, I critiqued it as well. You know, I thought some things, even Rod would got the director would go back and forth, and there's some scenes that didn't make it, and you know, I was there for some of the ADR, like behind the scenes. So I mean, the detail that they put into it, yeah, it's pretty spot on for what it is, and it was really cool to like just see. A lot of people don't know this, but Rod's son actually died of a heart complication like a month into filming. So he actually, they almost didn't even finish the movie. So he went home, had to bury his son, flew back, and ended up finishing a movie. So just the entire project and people involved, there were a lot of like significant mementos that people wanted to accomplish this film for and in response of. So it was really cool to see it all come out. We had a little bit of a hiatus. It was supposed to be at South by Southwest this year released. But other than that, it's done well on iTunes and, you know, it's been well received, like I said, so it's pretty cool.
That's awesome. And I'd be remiss not to mention, you also have a nonprofit you work with?
I do. So, well, Team RWB is one that I've been with. And then I was with Iraq Afghanistan Veterans Association. I did some work with them back in the day. Right now, I have another. So I did some like all into holistic approach in terms of just my lifestyle and kind of working with veterans with post-traumatic stress. I work with some psilocybin farms down in Jamaica. And so I have a nonprofit called Heroic Hearts Project. I went down on the University of Georgia and did ayahuasca with a whole bunch of combat veterans in Peru last year. And so, yeah, so Heroic Heart Projects is a nonprofit that I'm really trying to get involved with more and kind of getting a holistic approach and kind of taking combat and team guys down to Peru and doing some ayahuasca ceremonies for them. So it's really, really been a cool journey over the last year. Obviously, this year's things are kind of in hiatus, but...
What else are you doing?
So I have a company called Hemphydrate, which is 3 years ago, I met the CEO. He's out of Canada. Extract hemp and put it into purified drinking water. But ultimately I got into it because his son had Tourette's and I was looking for, you know, more holistic approaches. But I had it in about 13 NFL locker rooms and we're based out of California. And now I brought it over with me to Nashville. So it's called Hemphydrate. It's a really cool product. We do CBD roll-ons and water infused topical. So available online and a lot of our resources and funds go back to veterans with TBI and post-traumatic stress disorder. So it's kind of a cool.
Absolutely. That's fantastic, man. That is really, really fantastic. I appreciate everything you're doing for the veteran community. And again, thank you for your service.
Yeah, that's kind of been where I'm at. Focusing a lot of my energy on music right now, which is pretty special for me. And yeah, man, there's just there's a lot of runway left for D-Rod, I suppose. So,
I think that's awesome. I think it's awesome that you are doing your part to help veterans deal with the hidden wounds of war, because I think that is one of the hardest things that we as a community have to deal with that still so many guys don't want to talk about and fall victim to. So I admire the hell out of you for that. And I think I admire you even more so because you know, some people would say you got lucky. I think you've been presented with a lot of different opportunities, but then you did the work and you put in the energy to walk through those doors and make the most of all these opportunities that have been given to you. So I think that's extremely admirable that you've carved out this life for yourself that started out with barely graduating high school, not knowing what you wanted to do with your life. And now you've done all of this amazing stuff. And you have what I think is great. You have a book and a movie to commemorate a very impactful time in your life. So I think that'll be great for you, for your family, for many generations to come. And also for many future military leaders and soldiers to learn from. So I think that really is so admirable that you were willing to put that on paper and then also to be in the movie. So Daniel, it has been a pleasure. I respect the hell out of you, man. I thank you for your service and thank you so much for joining us today.
I appreciate it, man. Thank you for your time, man. It was special. It was cool to talk to y'all. Thank you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Thanks.
All right, man. Take it easy.
Thanks again for Daniel for joining us and shout out to his life. What an incredible life, man. He's one of those, you know, we've had people on the show and we've talked about people on the show where we read through some of their bios and you're like, there's no way that's fucking true. Like, that you could have done all those different things. My great uncle, my wife's great uncle, is one of those guys, Jack Sims. I've talked about him on the show before, where he fought in Iwo Jima, came back, went to Auburn to go to school to become a journalist, covered the very first Daytona 500, the first Super Bowl. He went to the World Series, did all this thing, came back, taught journalism. And you're like, there's no way that's somebody's life. Daniel Rodriguez is living a life that a lot of Americans don't know about, and it's beyond spectacular. Good
really
on
is.
Him, man.
What it really is. He's just making the most of the gifts he's been given. And I watched The Outpost, and I really do recommend it. It's got great scores on Rotten Tomatoes and everything. Excellent movie. I thought they did a great job after speaking with Daniel and then reading the story and then actually just watching it. It seems like they really got it very close to accurate. But I will say, don't watch it at night and just be prepared to be moved because it is a very intense movie, but I do recommend it.
All right. One more thing about that I want to mention quickly, because some of the other characters or some of the other people that are featured in the Outpost, we've had them on the show, and it's Romache and Carter. They are both Medal of Honor recipients. If you go back through our feed on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you listen to ZBT, you can hear those stories from them, from their own mouths, and how they remember everything. And I think that's a super interesting aspect about a lot of these battles and a lot of these experiences. We know so much about the Battle of Marja, the Battle of Fallujah, the Battle of Ramadi, and the Battle of Danny Boy, and things like that, on and on and on. But each person that lived in those battles and in those stories has their own little library of thoughts of how it occurred to them. And each aspect of that is incredibly important. We've talked to people that we know a lot about what happened in D-Day. It's different when you hear it from somebody's that was theirs mouth, and you hear the first kind of story rather than reading it from Stars and Stripes or wherever you get your news. I think that kind of thing is vastly underrated in our society today. We see the news and the information. Kyle and I talk about it on for longtime toolies, where we have to be careful about what projects I'm doing and putting out there, because the attention span of people is so short. They'll care for 1 second. And if you don't snap them up in that 1 second, they don't care anymore. Let's care a little bit more. We're going to care about the story in round number six of what's going on in Japan. Kate, walk us through what's going on there.
All right. Yamato on Thursday became the first municipality in Japan to attempt to stop people using their smartphones while walking outside in public places. So much like the Maria, is it the same rule in the army cons where you cannot walk and talk on your cell phone at the same time?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so I guess pretty much anywhere in the military, if you're taking a cell phone call, you must stop where you're standing and do the call. When you're done and you hang up, you can start walking again.
Because it's unprofessional.
It's unprofessional, apparently. It's inside, it's outside, and I always thought that that was absolutely insane and ridiculous, that it looks bad, whatever. But even after I got out, it took me like a year to start continuing to walk when I'm on. Like, people would call and I would stop in my tracks and answer it for like way after I got out. But that's happening in a province of Japan now. Following the passage of a draft ordinance in the city's assembly in Kanagawa Prefecture, the rule will come into effect next Wednesday. It does not, however, carry any penalties for those who ignore it.
The social shaming, baby. I love it.
Yep, a little social shaming. The city said it hopes people will recognize that smartphones should be used when not in motion. According to the ordinance, pedestrians should stop in place where they are not obstructing traffic. Very helpful to add that in there. If they want to use their smartphones in streets and parks. In January, the city conducted a study at two locations, observing a total of around 6,000 pedestrians, and found that 12% were using their smartphones while walking.
I imagine the people that are taking those numbers, every time they make a tick, they're like,
bing, 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 bing.
They're just so disappointed.
I see it here in the city all the time. There's 100 people on the subway steps during normal, non-COVID times. Whoever gets to the top of the steps, as soon as they get service, they stop and they stand there on their cell phones and they're looking, or they start walking really slow. And then all of a sudden, like 300 people bunch up behind them, are all getting jammed because one moron slows down to look at their phone. Like, it happens all the time on the streets. I'm like, I'm trying to get around these people. I'm in a rush because I'm always late. And these people are really ruining my vibe. But yeah, it is a thing. And you've also seen those viral videos where somebody's looking at their phone or talking on their phone deep in thought, and they fall into a fountain, or they walk into traffic, or all sorts
of...
Shout out Michael Scott. Like, all sorts of shit happening. So I can see it becoming a thing where, you know, people
are
just
kind of
annoyed.
And I can see there becoming a fine, too, because Japan does not fuck around with being polite. They are a very polite culture. Like, and for instance, in Japan, I don't know if you guys know this or not, but if you're crossing the street, doesn't matter if it's a major highway or anything. If you stop... if you're going across the street, you put your hand up, everybody has to stop.
Like, oh, interesting.
It doesn't matter if there's a red light, green light. You put your hand up, especially if you're a child, and you put your little Dick Skinner high in the sky. Children don't have Dick Skinners, but if you're an adult male, put your Dick Skinner high in the sky, then they let you cross the street. Yeah, whoever. Everybody can skin dick. But they have to let you go. It's just a polite society, which I appreciate. I love that aspect about Japan.
Yeah, and I mean, just pick your phone up, and I'm just as guilty as anybody else looking at my phone and walking, but I'm reminded of one time in the city, I'm walking with Alex, and we're crossing the street, and we're going to a store. She's buried in her phone, and I'm walking. We walked right past Bono, from U2,
no.
And she didn't even know it. Not that we're particularly huge
U2 fans. Did you ask him how you could get his album off your fucking phone?
No, this is prior to that, actually. But it was just, you know, one of those things where, you know, look up once in a while, especially in Manhattan, when you consider the gravitas of Manhattan and how cool it is. I think more people need to quote Ferris Bueller, you know, stop and look around once in a while.
I remind myself of that all the time, and my subway is above ground once it hits Queens. And I'm always on my phone the whole time. And sometimes I stop and I'm like, wow, it's really cool looking out the window at all these different neighborhoods and the skyline and blah, blah, blah. Like, I'm missing some really cool views because I'm always on my phone. But I can see this kind of catching on elsewhere. It's just annoying. It's annoying to be in crowds when people are like zombies on their phones, even though it's different when I do it.
And we are terrible about that, too. Like, if you work in our industry or do what we're constantly on our phones.
I live on my phone.
But
yeah,
I am
sad.
So judgmental. If I'm not and other people are,
right,
like
yeah.
If I'm at like a concert or at a play and people are looking down, I'm like, oh, God, just get off your phone. Knowing that my screen time for that day is like 9.5 hours.
Yeah. Yeah, whenever I was at a comedy show and I saw somebody doing it, I would just look back and forth between them and the comedian and them and the comedian. I'm like, come on, roast their asses. Get them. Mm-hmm. Come on.
But, oh, there's nothing. There's nothing. And I got to say this quietly because she's going to hear me. But there's nothing I hate more than introducing someone to a new show or a movie and you're watching it and you know it's good and you want them to enjoy it and you look over and they're buried in their phone.
Or at the end of that show, they say, I wasn't really that interested.
Yeah,
because you know,
we're not hearing her side of the story where it's the 15th time he's tried to make her watch The Guardian with Ashton Kutcher and she's over it.
It's really great. Watch it. He like jumps out of this helicopter and starts swimming.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah, come
on. Really cool.
We'll try one more time.
It is really cool. But that is cool. Dakota Meyer actually had that on his Instagram story. He was doing some training with some firefighters and paramedics in Austin where they're over Lake Travis and they had this helicopter and this dude was just swinging from a fast rope underneath the helicopter, like 40 or 50 feet above the water. And I was thinking, I don't do that kind of stuff anymore. That stinks. But fast roping with a dog and being on a helicopter with a dog, not fun.
Different story.
Assholes. Yeah. Psycho almost bit my dick in half. All right, let's move on to safe rounds and alibis. Kate, we'll start with you.
I have an exciting weekend of travel. Tonight after radio, I am heading down to Virginia Beach, where I didn't realize there's a military Marine Corps Camp Pendleton at Virginia Beach, too. Like a little tiny base there called Pendleton or something like that.
Oh, really?
But
I didn't know that.
My cousin Joe is retiring from the Marine Corps after over 20 years. So he is top of the top, Master Gunnery Sergeant. And he was always really supportive of me when I was in. And there's a little clump of Marines in my family. And so we're all going to go down to Virginia Beach. We have little Airbnbs, so we're not in like huge crowds or anything. But going to go to...
Interview him and ask him what he'd change? We'll have that as a round, maybe?
Yeah, I would love to interview him and get his thoughts on things. Again, he was always so supportive of... I remember being at MOS school and about to do my pistol qual, and he was in, like, air traffic control, stuff like that. But, I mean, he did, I want to say, like, 6 or 7 deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. Like, he was just always deploying. And me calling him and being like, you know, he's in the middle of these deployments. And I'm like, I got pistol call this week. You tell me some advice for holding the gun. Like, and he was just always very like, okay.
First of all, it's a weapon.
Yeah. First of all, it's a weapon. And please. But no, he was just always really awesome. So I'm excited to go down there. And I felt really honored that he asked me, that his family asked me to be down there for that, too. And also, too, I get so excited. Like, it's not often I'm on a military base anymore. Mm-hmm. And his Marines are going to be there. So to get to meet his Marines and, you know, obviously, the obligatory socially distance and everything will be spaced out. But I'm also excited to be on the beach and get a little beach time in. Hang out with some Navy SEALs. I've never been to Virginia Beach before, so I'm really looking forward to it. Maybe I'll come back engaged, you know? So.
Yeah, we read that list on radio yesterday. It's a good thing to do. Over there.
Yeah.
I think that Kate and I's our responses on military bases are very different. Whenever I'm on a military base, I look at people and I'm like, you nasty fucking worm.
And I just want to say hello to all of them.
You adorable little thing.
Squee! Yeah, I just want to, you know, I love walking around. Semper Fi, hey there, Devil Dog. I love letting them know I'm one of you. Hey there, Devil Dog. You know, so I'm really excited.
And I think that's weird. I think when people tell me now, if people tell me now, like, Semper Fi or Ra or anything like that, I always find it very uncomfortable now because I'm like,
it's like cringy.
You know what I do? I don't say it,
for no reason. I just am like, that's weird.
I always, when I see a Marine, there was an older Marine on the subway the other day who had the red hat on, the Korea. Mm-hmm. And I just, he was from across the train and we had our masks on.
That's very different. But Korean, older, I'm like, hell yeah.
I just pointed at his hat and did like a, like over my heart, like a little like nod to him. Like, I see you and I appreciate you. Mm-hmm. But I'm not really walking around going, hey, fellow double dog. I'm not doing that. But I do love talking.
That's what I thought you're walking and being like, hey-yat!
No, I'm not that bad, but I do love striking up conversations and like hearing their stories and where they're from. I love picking their brains and seeing where everybody comes from.
Kate's walking by some people. Give them one.
Yeah. On your left.
By your leave, good morning, gentlemen.
Yeah, I'm going to bring a glow belt down there, go for some jogs. Yeah, I just love being around Marines. That's all. I just really enjoy it. So looking forward to it.
Wow, that's a long save round from Kate. Cons, what do you got?
Just a few things very quickly. And Kate, you always take as much time as you want. That's the rule of save rounds.
Thank you, Connor.
So yes. I should mention, whenever I watch a movie and it's based on a true story, I'll Google and I want to read all about it. And I didn't realize, I knew about the two Medal of Honor recipients from the Battle of Camdish for the Battle of Kop Keating. I didn't realize it's the most decorated battle in the war in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. They had obviously the two Medals of Honor. They had 37 people received ARCOMs, Army Commendation Medals with Combat Vs, 18 Bronze Stars with Combat V, and 9 Silver Stars. So that was just unbelievable, the amount of awards that came out of that battle. And
Imagine being that battalion commander or regimental commander and having to sort through and put those into different piles of stones of who deserves a Silver Star or Bronze Star.
Right.
Because the line there is so small.
Yeah. Unbelievable. And I should mention Daniel Rodriguez was a Bronze Star with a V. So he
I thought bears Silver Star.
Mentioning. No, Bronze Star with a V.
Bronze Star?
Okay. Yeah. Quickly, I saw a picture from up at West Point. They started class, and they obviously are following all the social distancing rules. And one of the pictures they showed was outside in a tent. And our uniforms for class, even in the dead of summer, are wool pants. So a little part of me kind of smirks and says, that sucks. You have to sit outside in wool pants. That stinks. Mm. And then finally,
the cleaning bill must be outrageous.
It's wild.
It is. Yeah, just imagine that sweat that's happening in those wool pants. Mm. Finally, I haven't mentioned it in a while, but one of the organizations I work with, Operation Heal Our Heroes, is always trying to raise money, and we partner with Headstrong to raise money to help veterans get that free mental health care that they so absolutely deserve. And this year, because of everything that's going on, we couldn't do our annual 5K out in Montauk. So what we're doing this weekend, if you go to OperationHOH.com, you can do a virtual 5K. So if you are interested in doing a 5K, I already got Nardini.
Can I do it on a scooter?
You can do it any which way you want, pal. Any which way. I got Nardini signed up already. So anybody else who would like to run the Operation H virtual 5K this weekend, go to OperationHOH.com.
Maybe I'll do two. Maybe I'll do mini bike and scooter.
Dude, that'd be awesome. So,
all right, Kyle, what do you got?
All I got is, it's kind of big. One of the Tuskegee Airmen, it was a Chief Master Sergeant James Cotton, died in Pittsburgh. He was born and raised there. He was 93. He was one of the original Tuskegee Airmen. He did 21 years in the service. And it just kind of sucks. Like, all these, they're all 90. All these guys are dying and all their stories. We're not going to have firsthand accounts anymore. And so whenever one of these guys go, it's important to remember what they did and kind of call it out, because that ain't going to be the case in 5 more years. So
yeah.
Thoughts to his family, and thank him for his service in a really, really tough time to be in the service for him. So that's all I got.
To stay in after how they were treated and to stay in for 21 years is incredible.
Yeah.
Is that it, Kyle?
That's all I got.
All right. My save round, I want to give Kyle a shout out. Kyle is an unbelievably hard worker, and I appreciate the efforts that he puts into this show beyond measure. I tell him that in private, but I think it's always appropriate to tell people in public. Kyle, I appreciate you and what you do. Thanks, and what you mean to this show.
Yeah, he runs all of our social. He edits the pod. He creates all of our like video clips and everything.
Does all my videos for a long time. Stoolies does that. Stoolies, social does everything.
And I think I might have – I know I've said it to Chaps and Kate. Kyle, I actually don't know if I've ever said this to you. But you've really taken ZBT to the next level, because nothing against any of the producers we've ever had, but their shortcoming was they'd never been in the military themselves. Mm-hmm. And you have to have been in the military to fully understand and appreciate all the humor. And obviously you get that for the reasons that you – because you were in the military. And that's just added an extra element. So I'm very appreciative.
Thanks,
of
guys.
That. You're so valuable to us.
I appreciate just being a part of it. It's real important, I think. We joke around and we have a lot of fun, but it's good. It's good for me, too. It's great to stay connected to the veterans and kind of make dick jokes and not get looked at weird. And I really enjoy it. I appreciate just being a part of it, and it's kind of funny. Just thank God for the code. That's all.
Yeah. And I think that this is one of my favorite aspects about ZBT is that when I talk to my psychiatrist, when I talk to our psychologist, when I talk to him and he asks, do you have a support group? I'm like, yeah, honestly, I meet with a group of veterans twice a week and we talk for an hour. And sometimes I forget that the mics are on. And I think that's what makes our show cool, is that it is just like some pals just kicking back and talking about what's going on in the world, current events, and getting
talking
off wild rabbit
robots.
Trails and like searching out different things and talking about dicks and making Kate have balls and all kinds of stuff. That's the beauty of this show. That's
Harry
why
buttholes.
We love ZBT, and hopefully it's why you listen to Sound the Retreat.